sooner or later, you can bet your life that every Jew in this building is going to say the same thing. He's a little too Jewish for my taste.
Shalom, and welcome to the Too Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is two-time National Jewish Book Award winning novelist Dara Horn, discussing her fine new novel, A Guide for the Perplexed. We'll also have a visit from our Too Jewish expert on the international scene, Tom Price, and our new Mevina on Israel, Oshrat Barel. Please email your comments to us at TooJewishRadio@yahoo.com or visit us on the web at TooJewishRadio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Too Jewish.
Shalom. This is the very last Too Jewish Radio Show of the 5773 calendar year, which means that Rosh Hashanah, the Jewish New Year, is very, very close indeed. In fact, this coming Wednesday night and Thursday and Friday, if you're conservative or Orthodox, we'll observe the Festival of the Shofar, of remembrance, of judgment, and of new beginnings. Rosh Hashanah is the start of the 10 days of repentance, when we turn back, examine our deeds in the past year, and seek to return to the best that is within us. It is on Rosh Hashanah that, in the traditional understanding of things, God judges us and writes us into the Sefer HaChaim, the Book of Life, we hope and pray at least. For 10 days, from Rosh Hashanah through Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement that falls this year on Saturday, September 14th, we have the opportunity to lobby for an appeal of any divine judgment against us, to attempt to avert the severe decree. It's a complex time of year, both joyous and serious. We gather with friends and family for delicious meals, enjoy holiday treats, hear the beauty of the shofar and the gorgeous music of the High Holy Days. But it's also the days of awe, a little bit of fear in there when we seek to return to the best within us and to apologize to those we have wronged or hurt, to make atonement to God for what we failed to do well this past year. We wish the coming 5774 year to be not only happy, but genuinely good. And so we push ourselves in this season and try to explore both who we are now and what we can become. That means, in an interesting way, that we must confront the simple fact of our own mortality. We are only on this earth for a limited time, and the way we conduct ourselves determines our true legacy. As it says in the prayers we'll chant on Rosh Hashanah, man comes from dust and returns to dust. Our lives are just like a dream that passes, but God lives forever. Therefore, we take stock and see how we can make our lives and our world better right now. To play us in on this serious Rosh Hashanah theme this morning, here's Adam Yesodo Me'afar, as sung by my father, Rabbi and cantor Baruch Kohan. Our origin is dust, dust our end, but God, who lives forever, can redeem each of us. That was Adam Yesodo Me'afar from the Rosh Hashanah liturgy, coming up this week, Wednesday night and Thursday and Friday, if you're conservative or Orthodox. This is also Labor Day weekend, and during a busy time of year, it marks the only real pause in a fall filled with activity. Since we rabbis and cantors are working overtime right now, preparing for the coming High Holy Days, it's wonderful to have a celebration of labor today. This is our 12th Labor Day edition of Too Jewish, by the way, which speaks to our long and tireless efforts to bring you the finest Jewish programming imaginable. Hard and caring labor. So while you're preparing for barbecues and concerts and such and getting ready to enjoy the last real work day off before Thanksgiving, here's a bit about the holiday that has an interesting history and a good deal of meaning for Jews. Long before it was an excuse for a three-day weekend, Labor Day was a significant statement about the value of a human being's hard work. When it started, the concept that labor had value, morally and economically, was controversial, as it remains in some quarters today. Labor Day was created in the 1880s as a way to celebrate and support working men and women. It was a way of saying that labor mattered, that capital wasn't the only positive value in the economy or society. There are still folks who question that assertion, but they are not right. We Jews have always believed labor has moral quality. One of the great sentences in Pirkei Avot, the Mishnah tractate completed in the year 200 CE or so, the ethics of our ancestors, says, Al shlosha devarim haolam omeid, al ha-Torah ve'al ha-avodah ve'al gmilut chasadim. The world is based on three things, on Torah, on work, and on acts of selfless kindness. The Hebrew word avodah, labor, primarily means practical and prosaic work as we know it, but it also implies divine service. That connection of labor to serving God is intentional. For Jews, honest work is an important form of prayer. The exaltation of basic labor as a foundation of society and a way to serve God is consistent throughout Judaism. You might not know that until quite recently, being a rabbi wasn't a paid profession. Most of the great rabbis and scholars in Jewish history had day jobs. From Rabbi Yochanan HaSandlar, a sandal and shoemaker in the days of the Talmud, to Maimonides, the 12th century physician in Spain, to the rabbis of Eastern Europe who made a living in the lumber trade or as butchers. For Jews, not only has there never been any shame in hard work, there's been a kind of exaltation of it. Shouldn't be any surprise that many of the great organizers of labor in history have been Jews, that a movement based on exalting work, the labor Zionists, settled and then created the State of Israel and formed much of its culture. Here in America, we should note that important names in labor, from Samuel Gompers to Emma Goldman, were Jewish. Gompers, the founder and longtime president of the American Federation of Labor and a guiding force in the development of the American labor movement and Labor Day itself, once said, Labor Day differs in every essential way from the other holidays of the year in any country. All other holidays are in a more or less degree connected with conflicts and battles of man's prowess over man, strife and discord for power and greed, of glories achieved by one nation over another. But Labor Day is devoted to no man, living or dead, to no sect, race or nation. It celebrates all of our work, as Gompers might have said, our avodah, our service, in a meaningful way. So, enjoy today off of labor. Unless, of course, you are a rabbi and Rosh Hashanah is 4 days away. Remember, it's workers who built our country and who maintain our society. When we return on Too Jewish in a few moments, we'll meet our hard-working guest, a young mother of four. She's had a lot of labor, who is here on Too Jewish for a fourth time, a near record. It's two-time National Jewish Book Award-winning author Dara Horn. Her new novel is called A Guide for the Perplexed. Find out why it might just be Too Jewish right here on Too Jewish.
A Taste of Judaism, the largest and most successful outreach program in the country, celebrates its 14th anniversary year. Over 5,000 people have completed the course offered by Temple Emmanuel, Arizona's first congregation. Now, it's your turn. Taste of Judaism is free and open to all, Jewish or not. Rabbi Sam Kohan and Rabbi Batsheva Appel explore the history and practice of Judaism in 3 2-hour sessions on spirituality, values, and community. Taste of Judaism is an exciting opportunity for anyone who wants to gain an understanding of Jewish culture, history, rituals, community, and practice. The class includes delicious tastes of traditional Jewish foods. Taste of Judaism offers daytime and evening classes in Central, Northwest, and East Tucson, plus the very popular Taste of Judaism Family Class, held at Tucson Hebrew Academy. Adults enjoy a grown-up taste class, while kids enjoy Jewish stories, crafts, and activities with excellent THA teachers. There's no fee or obligation, but space is limited and pre-registration is required. Call Mila Vassar at 520-327-4501 for more information and to register today. That's 520-327-4501.
Parents in Tucson have many choices on where to send their children to school. Consider the best. Consider Tucson Hebrew Academy. Now is the time to secure your spot for the upcoming school year. With a beautiful Foothills K through 8 campus and award-winning academics, you owe it to your children to visit THA, Tucson Hebrew Academy, and see what they have to offer. Your child belongs at THA. THA delivers. Low student-teacher ratio supports successful, rigorous academics, and they don't stop there. With an emphasis on the arts, science, and music, THA students learn the Hebrew language and are taught Jewish values along with a rigorous academic curriculum. Your child deserves the best. Call 529-3888 to schedule your tour of THA. Financial aid is available. Don't wait. Space is limited. That's 529-3888 or visit www.thaaz.org. We are delighted to welcome to Jewish a favorite guest, not just a guest, Dara Horn. She's the novelist, award-winning Jewish novelist, author of a new book, A Guide for the Perplexed, which has just come out. And you should get it and read it, like all of her books. Good morning and welcome.
Thank you for having me.
So it's called A Guide for the Perplexed, not, as Maimonides had it, A Guide to the Perplexed. Let's talk about the title a little bit.
Sure. Well, as you mentioned, the title is borrowed, Lahavdil, not to compare myself, of course,
Maimonides.
But it's borrowed from Maimonides, yes. Maimonides being the 12th century Jewish philosopher. He was also the doctor to the Egyptian sultan. He lived in Cairo in the Middle Ages and really the tech capital of the world at that time. And Guide to the Perplexed, his book, is really his theology, and it talks a lot about his approach to how to describe God and this sort of thing. But what intrigued me most about it, and the theme that I addressed really in the book, is the question of fate and free will, of how much of our lives are within our own control and how much of our lives is beyond our control. And for him, it's a religious question about how God is able to allow for human free will. But to me, it's not only a religious question, but also a question about pushing the boundaries of human knowledge and human ability. And in my novel, my novel's about a software developer, and I suppose we'll talk more about the story in a moment. But the reason I call it A Guide for the Perplexed is really because it introduces some of those same questions, because both Maimonides and people in our time, of course, always are living on the cutting edge of science and the furthest boundaries of human knowledge.
And maybe pushing beyond them a little bit, which has been the subject of some of your other work. In putting together, thinking of technology, Maimonides, of course, himself was a scientist, so it does sort of seem like a natural fit as a physician. When you come up with an idea for a book, when do you know it's going to be your novel?
Oh, if only I knew. if I knew, I wouldn't be throwing away hundreds of pages before I arrived at an idea. I often write, 100 pages and throw it away, and then, some remnant of that becomes an idea. But this novel is something, the core of this novel is something that I've been thinking about for most of my life, which is the biblical story of Joseph. Joseph and his brothers, the story of, Joseph being this sort of very talented but also very arrogant person who has this almost magical ability, or supernatural ability, divine ability to predict the future by interpreting dreams. And his brothers, of course, become very jealous of him, and also he's the most loved son in the family. His father's he's his father's favorite child. And of course, they sell him into slavery, and then things get worse before they get better from there. The story's always fascinated me. I think it's really important that, first of all, because I think it's very important that a lot of the world's oldest stories, including, of course, many in the Torah, are about sibling rivalry. Not really because it's true that mom always loves you best, but really because siblings are people who share a past but not a future. And the story of Joseph is interesting to me because it raises that question of how much of our lives we control and how much of our lives we can't. And what Joseph does in that story is, to me, a really fascinating thing, because when he reunites with his brothers at the end of the story, and his brothers, of course, have committed all these terrible crimes and sold him into slavery, he tells them, don't be angry at yourselves that you sold me into slavery, because it was to save life that God sent me ahead of you.
Right.
This is an astonishing thing to say. I mean, these are the people who really tried to destroy his life. And what I think is interesting about that statement is it suggests that it's one of two things, or possibly both. Either he has this insight into God's plan for humanity, which it's quite possible he does. He has this ability to interpret dreams. But second, and more importantly, because more relevant for those of us who don't have that talent, he is, in a sense, instead of controlling the future, he's controlling the past. He's looking back at the events that have happened in his life, and he's determining that of those events, he's making a decision to interpret them in a certain way that allows him to move forward. He's saying to them, this all was for the best. God sent me ahead of you. This was what made it possible for you to survive the famine. But think about the kind of selective memory you need to have in order to say that. Well, you know, you sold me into slavery, but don't worry about that. It's all for the best. I think at this time of year at Rosh Hashanah, it's also a very valuable lesson, because it tells us that what matters most is not everything you remember. And of course, in Judaism, we have this huge emphasis on memory. It's not what you remember that matters as much as how you remember it and how you select from the things in your past a meaningful story.
It's a great point, and we will talk much more about that, about computer programming and how that interacts with the mystical and science, when we come back with author Dara Horn here on Too Jewish. Among my most pleasant, at least time-consuming duties, I have the honor of serving as president of the Kohan Memorial Foundation, which celebrates the memories of Rabbi Samuel S. and A. Irma Kohan, my own grandparents. Once a year, the foundation gives a substantial cash award to an individual for outstanding service to Klal Yisrael, the totality of the Jewish people. This service can involve any one of four different fields: unity, education and information, creative arts, or rescue. If you know of anyone who might qualify for the 2013 Kohan Award, just visit our website, www.kohanaward.com, C-O-H-O-N, and you'll find the nomination form to submit. And while you're there, you can also learn just who my own grandparents were and who participates in honoring their memory today. That's kohanaward.com, C-O-H-O-N-A-W-A-R-D. It's a good visit.
If you're like most people, your biggest purchase is your home. Don't you wish there was someone you could turn to who not only had knowledge and experience, but who truly cared about you? If you're looking to buy or sell a home, you need to know Jill Rich. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. With over 20 years of experience, Jill's one of Tucson's top realtors. She specializes in all kinds of residential property. She can find you a starter house or a castle. Jill will find you the perfect home. While the stock market has wild gyrations, real estate grows in value. If you want to invest in income property, Jill can guide you. And if you're thinking about selling your home, Jill provides a personal marketing program to sell your house fast. You can reach Jill Rich at Realty Executives River Road office, 615-8400. Jill provides strong representation in a caring way. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. Jill Rich, call 615-8400.
If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at twojewishradio@yahoo.com or visit our website at twojewishradio.com, where you can stream all past and present shows. Or go to Apple iTunes Store and download our popular Jewish podcasts. are delighted to welcome back our Mevina on Israel, Oshrat Bar-El. She's the Shlicha, the representative of Israel at the Weintraub Israel Center here in Tucson. Boker Tov and Lashana Tova.
Boker Tov to you too, and Lashana Tova.
So Rosh Hashanah is just a few days away. Mm-hmm. Are there any, you're from a Moroccan background, any Moroccan specialties having to do with Rosh Hashanah?
I will start with a general background about the Moroccan. This morning I asked my oldest one, Yuval, what do you like the most about the Moroccan tradition? And, you know, she looked at me and she said, first, I love the most the happy, like they're so happy people, and I like their food. And since we're...
I like their food too, I just have to say.
And since we are just a few days before Rosh Hashanah, I will say that most of our food during the year will be very spicy. But before Rosh Hashanah, it will be mostly sweet. Like they will use lots of sugar, honey, and all kind of that. And actually, I brought today something for you to taste, and it's pity that the other can't, but the one that already got invitation for our open house event
during the holiday of Sukkot, yeah, I might add, coming up soon,
could taste some. Please contact the Jewish Federation for more information about this.
So I have to talk about it, and I feel a little bit guilty, which is, of course, a strong Jewish tradition, especially this time of year, that I can't have all of the listeners taste this. But one of the things you gave me is a watermelon rind in sugar, sort of soaked in either honey or sugar. And your mother made all of these fantastic mm-hmm. specialties, and there's a variety of other delicious things. I'm just going to tempt my guests so they can know that we are having a sweet year. So anything with sugar or honey for the new year to make it tasty and sweet.
But the fish. The fish will be spicy, but the meat and all the rest, like even there is some vegetables that we will use only in Rosh Hashanah, so they will cook with some honey or pomegranates or dates, something that will add some sweet flavor to the dish.
And hopefully a sweetness to the new year.
Yeah, of course.
L'shana tova metuka, a good and a sweet year for you, and several sweet years here in America for you.
Thank you very much. L'shana tova.
L'shana tova. We'll talk next week. Actually, we'll talk next year.
Yeah.
When we come back on Two Jewish, we'll hear from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, and get the old Jewish joke of the week.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
And an early L'shana Tova.
And to you.
We started talking last week about human rights and civil rights and focused first on America. Let's talk about Europe a little bit, the kinds of agreements that now exist and the reality or lack of accomplishment of some of those.
All right. Well, one of the oldest documents or declarations in the world on this subject comes from the French Revolution, and it was the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, often mistranslated as the rights of men. Les droits de l'homme means human rights, actually. And it was a lofty document, as so many other ideals of the French Revolution, like freedom, equality, brotherhood, never fully realized.
Liberté, égalité, fraternité.
Right. But in a much more modern context, there was a long process called the Helsinki Process, which was a series of conferences that began back in the late 60s. And eventually produced a document called the Helsinki Final Act, which was a signed, legally binding document representing the negotiated positions of about 35 countries back in the day which participated in a process called the Conference on Security and Cooperation in Europe. And basically, the West made a big trade-off with the East. We said, okay, we'll let up on the arms race so you don't have to bankrupt yourselves and make your people wear cardboard shoes if you let up on the human rights situation and allow a little bit of travel, allow a little bit of freedom of the press, a little bit of freedom of religion.
Some emigration.
Right. And basically enshrined into the language of this international agreement was the notion that the human rights situation inside country X was properly the concern of the whole community of nations and not strictly an internal affair.
It's not just our problem and we deal with our Jews or our blacks or whomever,
so the
our
line
gypsies.
Of, for example, the Soviet Union or South Africa or whatever oppressive regime used to be, this is our problem, keep your nose out. We don't tell you how to run your school system, don't tell us how to run ours. Well, once the Helsinki Final Act was signed, that idea was thrown out. And it was recognized that the human rights situation in any country is properly the concern of the entire international community, which is an idea echoed in the Passover Seder, that as long as somebody somewhere is enslaved and lacks freedom, in some sense, we're all slaves. It's a very Jewish idea. It's a very biblical idea. And what that means essentially is that what started off as a very limited agenda to promote free and fair elections and have a little bit of dissidence and criticism allowed in the press in countries that were then part of Eastern Europe has now spread, and the agenda includes issues like the treatment of minorities such as Roma and Sinti, more popularly known as Gypsies, combating anti-Semitism, combating trafficking in women and children, combating altogether the oppression of women or minors, protecting people with various types of handicaps. All of this stuff has become the subject of scrutiny by what has grown into the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe. And we can talk a little bit more about that and some current issues in Europe next week.
Thanks, Tom. We will talk then. A happy and a healthy new year.
And to you and all your listeners as well.
Thank you. It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. This one is a Rosh Hashanah classic for the coming new year, Wednesday and Thursday and maybe Friday this week. Abe has a pet parrot he's very fond of. In fact, this is such a smart parrot that he teaches him how to daven, how to pray. Pretty soon, the parrot is chanting the liturgy of the morning service quite beautifully. So Abe decides to teach the parrot to chant the prayers of the High Holy Days. And the parrot learns to sing them, all the prayers, Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur included, perfectly. In fact, actually becomes something of a pest, chanting High Holy Day melodies all day and night. At daily services one day in the Minyan, Abe brags to his friends about this parrot, how it chants services magnificently. And his friends don't believe him. Yeah, sure, your parrot chants Hineni. Oh, yeah, your parrot is a cantor. Hoo-ha. They ridicule him mercilessly. Finally, Abe angrily bets all of them the parrot can indeed chant services. Hundreds and then thousands of dollars are wagered. Rosh Hashanah arrives. He brings his parrot to the temple, sets him up on the bima in front of the congregation, and says, "Okay, parrot, do your stuff." But nothing happens. Not a sound comes out of the parrot's mouth. Abe tries jiggling the bird's perch, cajoling it. "Come on, parrot, sing already, a little Lishana Tova." Finally resorts to threatening it, but nothing helps. The parrot is silent. Finally, in abject humiliation, Abe grabs his parrot and leaves the shul in shame, with the catcalls of his friends ringing in his ears. On the way home, Abe gives the parrot what for. "You miserable, flea-ridden bag of feathers, I'll murder you. I'll fricassee you. I'll turn you into minced parrot. How could you humiliate me like that?" And the parrot says, "Shah, what are you worried about? Think of the odds we'll get on Yom Kippur." That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish just for you. You should live and be well and enjoy Rosh Hashanah. And now a word of Torah. This week, we'll celebrate the new Jewish year with joy on Rosh Hashanah, but we also engage over the 10 days of repentance in a cheshbon ha-nefesh, an accounting of the soul, that requires that we read some challenging texts from the Torah. The reading for Rosh Hashanah is the Binding of Isaac, the Akedat Yitzchak. We Reform Jews read it Thursday on the first day of Rosh Hashanah, while Orthodox and Conservative Jews read it on Friday on the second morning of Rosh Hashanah. In a version of this complex tale from Genesis, Abraham is told to sacrifice his beloved son Isaac on Mount Moriah. Bob Dylan retold the story in his song Highway 61. He had Abraham object to killing his son and then apparently acquiesce out of fear for his own safety. Where does God want this killing done? According to Bob Dylan, out on Highway 61.
God said to Abraham, kill me a son. Abe said, man, you must be putting me on. God said, no. Abe said, what? God said, you can do what you want, Abe, but next time you see me coming, you better run. Well, Abe said, where you want this killing done? God said, all on Highway 61.
Now, in spite of his apparent biblical scholarship, Bob Dylan isn't exactly accurate to the text of Genesis. For one thing, in the Torah, Abraham doesn't object in the least to sacrificing Isaac or have to be threatened. Abraham just gets up early the next morning and heads for Mount Moriah to do the deed. For another, at the climax of the Akedah, just as Abraham is lifting the knife to slaughter Isaac, God sends an angel who prevents the killing. That angel, while acknowledging that Abraham has demonstrated full obedience to God, informs him that he's actually not supposed to kill his child, nor are any followers of God ever supposed to sacrifice their children. Weird and powerful as this is, and influential too, as poet Chaim Guri says, we are all born with that knife in our hearts. The essential message of the Akedah is that we are never supposed to sacrifice our children, that we are in fact commanded to teach them to choose life and mitzvot, not evil or sin. This Shabbat, along with the Rosh Hashanah Torah reading about Abraham offering up Isaac, who is replaced by a ram, by the way, that's where the ram's horn may come from on Rosh Hashanah, there's another powerful text. Rosh Hashanah's story of the near death of Isaac is paralleled by the Sabbath Torah reading of Ha'azinu, which tells of the coming death of Moses. It's a passage filled with poetry and pathos. These readings fall during a period when the Unetane Tokef prayer reminds us that on Rosh Hashanah it is written, on Yom Kippur sealed, who shall live and who shall die. It's a time of year when we're directly confronted with the truth of our own mortality and strongly encouraged to live better lives in the year to come. May we each find our own ways to make these powerful existential challenges an inspiration to live our lives in better, holier ways. When we come back on To Jewish, our guest, the delightful author Dara Horn, two-time winner of the National Jewish Book Award, will tell us about her brand new novel, The Guide for the Perplexed, which mixes computer programming, Moses Maimonides, and Solomon Schechter, and Egypt, among other subjects. Hear all about it when we return on To Jewish.
Environmental Strategies Incorporated was established in Arizona almost 15 years ago. They're a corporation that's very unique and has distinguished itself as one of the foremost environmental remediation companies in Arizona. Environmental Strategies, Inc. is also a full-service general contractor. The fact that they have two divisions affords their clients the opportunity to work with one contractor to deal with environmental problems as well as their building and remodeling needs. Environmental Strategies clientele range from single-family homeowners to multi-million-dollar Fortune 500 companies. So, if you're in need of asbestos abatement, mold remediation, or general contracting services, call Environmental Strategies at 884-1114. And, if you wish, ask for Ken Goodman, the president. He'd be more than happy to talk with you about your project. That's Environmental Strategies, 884-1114.
Folks, it's time for you to experience the Jim Click Kia difference. More discounts, more peace of mind, and more selection. 2013 Kia Soul is now starting at just $14,988 and only $159 a month. So drive home the fuel-efficient 2013 Kia Rio, special event price only $159 a month. And remember, Every Kia comes with a 10-year, 100,000-mile warranty. More discounts, more peace of mind, and more selection, 10 brands to choose from. That's the power to save. That's the Jim Click difference. Kia, the power to surprise.
We continue with our Two Jewish Update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
Syria was very much in the news this week. Even more incontrovertible evidence demonstrated yet again that Syrian President Bashar al-Assad has been poison gassing his own citizens. Now, finally, the international community, or at least the Americans, may be doing something about it. Doctors Without Borders, the humanitarian group based in France, says that at least 350 people were killed on August 21st in a poison gas attack led by the Syrian army on a rebel stronghold north of Damascus. Rebel forces say more than 1,000 people died. While this is certainly not the first time that Assad has slaughtered his own people during the protracted Syrian civil war, nor is it the first time that strong evidence has demonstrated his use of chemical weapons against civilians, this time the world is apparently more horrified and will finally take action. To put it mildly, it's about time. Russia, Syria, and the Assad family's longtime sponsor, protector, and arms supplier has continued to issue attacking Syria will destabilize the region warnings. But it appears that this time, finally, in spite of Russia's attempt to, I don't know, shield Syria, something will be done. How effective it is remains to be seen. It's worth noting that the international wave of hope, inspired by the Arab Spring just 16 months ago or so, has now almost completely subsided into various forms of political chaos and widespread violence in both Egypt and especially Syria. The other Arab nations involved, particularly Libya, Tunisia, and Yemen, are struggling with Islamist regimes that are radicalizing rather than democratizing society. It's so sad for both the Arab and Muslim worlds that this opportunity to begin to join the modern world is being missed, and apparently badly so. It is also sad for the closest neighbor to all of this chaos, Israel. The Israelis were always more skeptical than we Americans about the end result of the dramatic changes in the Middle East, the fall of all those dictators, no doubt reflecting on the fact that where the Arab world is concerned, pessimism is often too optimistic a philosophy. We hope and pray that the carnage in Syria ends soon. And we wonder just what the point of the UN is these days if it cannot be mobilized to stop a regime from genocidally killing its opponents. I must note that Bashar al-Assad is not the first member of his family to slaughter Syria's citizens. His father, Hafez al-Assad, memorably ordered the slaughter of the entire population of the town of Hama in 1982, an act executed by Bashar's uncle, Hafez's brother, Rifat al-Assad. 20,000 people died in that massacre, a fact that Syria more or less concealed for years, and for which no one was ever tried. It's about time the UN intervened in Syria, or that those with the military capability to stop the slaughter, like the US, do so. In preparations for the repercussions of a potential military strike on Syria, Israel is handing out gas masks to its own citizens. Nothing like happening to live in a very bad neighborhood. In a different neighborhood, in another news, Jews and Muslims in Poland have made common cause and are acting together. The directors of the Jewish Community Center of Krakow and the Krakow Islamic Center have joined to fight Poland's recent ban on Jewish and Muslim ritual slaughter of animals. Jonathan Ornstein, the JCC's executive director, and Dr. Haysam Obaidat, director of the Islamic Center, issued a joint open letter last week saying that their communities stand united and call on the Polish government and the Supreme Court, if necessary, to ensure that we have the right to ritual slaughter and can practice our traditions as Poland and the European Union allow. Poland's parliament rejected a law this summer that would have legalized both kosher slaughter, shchita, and Islamic halal ritual slaughter. The failure to legalize it was a great source of distress to both communities. The mistaken idea that such slaughter is particularly cruel to animals goes against the very reason it is called for in the tradition of our people, the joint Jewish-Muslim letter said. Muslim and Jewish practices demanding humane treatment of animals date back to the very founding of our faiths. We wish them success in opening the eyes of the Polish parliament, working together. And in New York, incidents of physical and sexual abuse at Yeshiva University were apparently not limited to its high school for boys, an investigation found. The investigation commissioned by the university was carried out by the New York-based law firm of Sullivan and Cromwell. It followed reports of sexual abuse by two faculty members at YU's high school for boys in the 1970s and 80s. The report that came out last week confirmed that multiple incidents of varying types of sexual and physical abuse took place at the Yeshiva University High School, perpetrated by individuals in positions of authority and continuing even after administration members were made aware of the problem. The probe found sexual abuse at other divisions of the university, but, citing litigation that's pending now, did not describe them in detail. Up until 2001, there were multiple instances in which the university either failed to appropriately act to protect the safety of its students or did not respond to the allegations at all, the report says. This lack of an appropriate response by the university caused victims at Yeshiva University to believe that their complaints fell on deaf ears or were simply not believed by the university's administration. YU President Richard Joel said in a statement, "There are findings set forth in this report that serve as a source of profound shame and sadness for our institution. On behalf of the Board of Trustees and the entire university community, I express my deepest and most heartfelt remorse and truly hope that our recognition of these issues provides some level of comfort and closure to the victims. Although we cannot change the past, we remain committed to making confidential counseling services available to those individual victims in the hope they can achieve a more peaceful future." Maybe a little bit too little, a little bit too late. It should be noted that Richard Joel, the head of Yeshiva University, is often listed as the single highest paid Jewish employee of any not-for-profit organization in the world. And finally, I was hoping to avoid the whole bar mitzvah boy over-the-top video controversy here on Too Jewish, but it just won't go away. First, a bar mitzvah boy named Sam Horowitz danced his way through a fully produced live music video at his reception in Dallas. It was better produced and much cleaner than, say, Miley Cyrus at the Video Music Awards. And then the famous Rabbi David Wolpe of Sinai Temple in West L.A. harshly criticized the kid and his family for this totally over-the-top expenditure of time, effort, and money on this mishigas. And then David Wolpe backtracked and apologized because the kid gave over $30,000 in bar mitzvah gift money to charity. Wow, that's a lot of bar mitzvah money. My guess is he doesn't need to save it for college tuition. Anyway, now young Sam Horowitz has been back on Good Morning America again. All of which goes to prove that a lot of people have no idea what a bar mitzvah is all about, but they sure know how to spend money on a fabulous party. Frankly, I'm kind of curious just how Sam did on his Haftorah and Torah portions, and whether he even understands what a bar mitzvah is really for. So call me maybe, it's hard to look right at your baby, but here's my number. Well, maybe call me old-fashioned, at least in the area of bar mitzvah celebrations. And that's the Too Jewish News of Jews around the world. We are delighted to welcome back to Too Jewish our guest this morning, author Dara Horn. She's the author of the new novel just released, A Guide for the Perplexed. She's also the author of All Other Nights, The World to Come in the Image, and a winner of two National Jewish Book Awards, and a favorite guest of Too Jewish. Welcome back, Dara, and almost L'Shana Tova.
L'Shana Tova, thank you for having me.
We're talking about your book, which focuses on computer programming. Are you a computer programmer?
Oh, no, I am not. No, I'm lucky if I know how to turn it on. I should say, though, I'm much less skeptical of technology than probably many people, many older people are, because I'm 36 years old, and I should say that my parents met in 1966 through the world's first computer dating service.
Seriously?
Believe it or not, yes. Yeah, it really did exist in 1966, mm-hmm. and that's how they met, and they're still married over 40 years later.
Well, it couldn't have been called J-Date. What was it called?
No, it wasn't J-Date. It was Operation Match. It was run by Harvard undergraduates who sold the service throughout the country to match college students up in different geographic areas. So my parents, that's how they met. They were compatible by the computer.
Pioneering electronic shadchanis. It's really fantastic.
Exactly. So my life itself is very tied up in this whole question of technology, in a sense. But my main character is a software developer, and she's very talented. She's also very arrogant.
She's your Joseph figure, of course, as we talked about earlier.
Yes, of course.
The show.
Yes, in this sort of, because I wrote the book really as a kind of a rewriting of the biblical Joseph story, but in contemporary times and with women instead of men. So she's my main character, and she's invited to, so she has this tremendously successful company that has created a program that records everything its users do. Of course, when I wrote this, it was fiction, and I feel like every day it becomes closer and closer to being a reality. But so it's a program that records everything its users do and then catalogs it according to their instincts. So, and then also has a feature that uses those instincts to predict your future. So in the opening scene of the book, her daughter has lost her shoes, and she just types in shoes, the daughter's name and the shoes into this program, and it immediately shows a picture of where they've been left in the car. So this is the kind of app that she's created. And the story begins when she's invited to do a 3-week consulting gig at the Library of Alexandria in Egypt, which does actually exist. It was rebuilt 10 years ago from this model from 2,000 years ago.
The greatest library in the world was in Alexandria. It was burned in Julius Caesar's time, and now they've rebuilt it. It's remarkable.
Yes, they actually have rebuilt it, and amazingly, it has the only backup of the Internet Archive of the records of every web page ever created since the 90s. It's all there in Alexandria, amazingly.
Wow.
So my character is invited to do a consulting gig there. She doesn't want to go, but her very jealous sister convinces her to go. And when she goes, this book does take place in contemporary Egypt. This isn't sort of Egypt's post-revolutionary chaos, which, of course, is only becoming more chaotic as we speak. While she's there, she's kidnapped, and she discovers that her talent for recording memories ultimately becomes her only means of escape.
It's a really interesting and intricate story, and it involves the Geniza. Maybe you could talk about that part of it, too, and
sure.
How Solomon Schechter shows up as a character, actually.
Yeah, Solomon Schechter is a character. Rambam Maimonides also is a character.
Right.
Definitely, this book could be classified, as you say, as too Jewish by some readers. But perhaps it depends on how you read it. Yes, there's a historical story in the book. I should say that the software program she's invented is called the Geniza. And Geniza is a Hebrew word that means a hiding place or a repository. And the Cairo Geniza was this enormous stash of medieval manuscripts that was discovered in a synagogue in Cairo. And this comes from the Jewish tradition of never destroying a document that has God's name in it. If you have a prayer book or a Torah or something like this that has God's name on it and it's damaged, you're not supposed to throw it away. You're supposed to bury it. And what many communities have done is, if they don't, it's not really worth going and getting a burial plot for like a page or a book. So they will have a room or a storage space where they accumulate these materials until they have enough to bury them. So there's a synagogue in Cairo, which is still standing and still open, although now mostly for tourists. This synagogue in Cairo is from the 10th century, and the Geniza that they had to keep these documents that were damaged was they had two unusual customs among Jewish communities. One is that they didn't just save anything that had the name of God written on it. They saved anything that was written in Hebrew letters, which, since they were a community that used Jewish languages, that meant almost everything. That means things like sales receipts and children's school books and things like that. The second thing that they did that was different from most communities is they never bothered to clean out this Geniza and bury the materials in 900 years. So what then happened was Solomon Schechter, whose name is familiar in this country from the schools, but who was a Cambridge professor in the 19th century, he discovered some of these manuscripts, and that's a whole other story how he found these manuscripts in England. But ultimately, he made a decision to go to Egypt to try to find out the source of these medieval manuscripts that kept coming on sort of the rare book market. And he went to Egypt. He charmed the Grand Rabbi of Cairo into showing him where this Geniza was, and they had this sort of door that was on the near the ceiling of the women's gallery in the synagogue. And he climbed up a ladder, he opened this door, and he looked down, and he saw what was essentially a well of paper. going back 900 years. And in typical British imperial fashion, he packed up all 200,000 documents and brought them back to Cambridge. Some of these were real literary treasures. Some of Maimonides' first drafts and things were found in there. There's poetry. There's many important, you know, versions of biblical books that had never been seen before. But most of it was things like business inventories, medical prescriptions, love letters, sales documents. I mean, this was not an archive. This was almost like the medieval Facebook. This was like every piece of junk you could possibly imagine. That it would be actually possible to recreate this entire world from it. And the only reason that you can't, or that we haven't been able to until now, is because it actually took them 100 years to catalog everything that they found.
I never thought about the Geniza as like a medieval Facebook, but you're quite right. It turns out that's the best source for example, medieval commerce and the Eastern Mediterranean and the role of Jewish traders and lots of other stuff. So it's a remarkable story, and in a way it's a thriller. Are you going to make a movie out of it?
Yes. Well, if you know anyone, you can give me a call.
I think it would work.
I mean, it's about a software developer who gets kidnapped in post-revolutionary Egypt. And to give you a little bit of the a little bit more of the plot, which hopefully you'll forget by the time you pick up the book, is she gets
spoiler alert here.
Yeah, spoiler alert. Well, not so much of a spoiler, but when she's kidnapped in it's sort of in this post-revolutionary chaos, the people who take her are kidnapping her for money, not realizing that people who run software startup companies never have any liquid capital, right? I mean,
it's all stock.
They never actually have cash.
No, right? They can't buy a sandwich, but they're worth millions.
Exactly. So, you know, not realizing that, you know, she's not going to be able to produce this enormous ransom. So when they realize this, they want to kill her, but then the reason they decide to keep her alive is because they discover that the Egyptian police are using her software for surveillance, and they then keep her alive to program a virus to destroy the Egyptian police records. And so she sort of becomes a kind of a software Scheherazade, where she has to keep, you know, she knows that they're going to kill her when she finishes this program, and the answer is, of course, to never finish.
Which sounds very comfortable for most software programmers that I personally have known. I want to thank Dara Horn for a great visit. Her book is called A Guide for the Perplexed, a novel. It's not only fascinating and complicated and intricate, but a great read. Strongly recommend it. One last question. You have 4 young children, and yet you're still extremely productive as a novelist. How do you manage?
After my last child was born, I invented an app that dilates time. So if you buy my book, then I can give it to you.
So we could use that in the coming holidays. L'shana tova tikatevu v'techatemu. Good luck on the book as well. Thanks so much,
Dara.
Shana tova. When we come back on Two Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical playout.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on this last 5773 edition of Two Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday, which is also next year, 5774 in the Jewish calendar, at 9 o'clock, when our guest will be Rabbi Alana Suskin of Americans for Peace Now. Our playout this morning comes from cantor David Dudu Fisher and his song Shana Tova, A Good Year. My friends, may you be blessed with l'shana tova tikatevu v'techatemu, a year of goodness and blessing. May you and your family be gifted by being written in the book of life for a healthy new year. Oh, and of course, have a shavua tov, a good week, and as always, a week, we pray, of peace.
Shana tova, shana tova, ba'anava. Kreva kavislicha dam ahava kavipius vegam shalva yamim holchim yamim bayim silchi gam at lachataim rab icholim simchino chesed uverachamim shana tova kirvi halom v'yad hoshiti l'shalom shana tova
shana tova
shana tova
Yeah.